Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Today I talk with author, teacher, athlete, and past writer laureate for Alaska, Frank Sose.
I think a person lives his life and questions occur, and you grow through some questions, you grow away from some questions, but others persist and you just keep coming back to them.
I hope you'll stick around for the next half hour. Almost 30 years ago, I found myself in a University of Alaska Fairbanks undergraduate creative writing class taught by Frank Sose. It's hard to overestimate the effect the class had on me. Until that time, only two teachers had radically changed the way I viewed the world, and that fall, I found the third. The thing is, looking at Frank, you would never peg him as a professor. He's tall, whipcord trim, and sturdily framed despite the height. He sports a mustache that vaguely suggests an outlaw in a John Ford Western. That changes when you hear him teach. He'll diffidently shuffle into class, cock his head as if trying to catch a phrase just out of earshot, and address students. Unfeelingly polite, he then leads, prods, and draws forth from the class observations about the assignments you only dimly imagined. All of this is to say Frank is a gifted teacher. He's also a lyrical and intelligent writer. Like Frank's appearance, his prose is deceptively casual, even conversational. But on reflection, you discover his deep understanding of literature and culture. His collection of short stories, Unified Field Theory, won the Flannery O'Connor Prize for Short Fiction. And just recently, he passed the baton as Alaska's Writer Laureate. He's also collaborated on wonderful book projects with visual artists, his wife, Margot Klass, and longtime friend, Kes Woodward. More personally, Frank contributed reviews to KUAC's Alaska Edition, a public radio show I helped produce. His range was impressive. Besides casting his critical eye on literature, he also reviewed performances by basketball teams competing at the top of the world tournament. Those reviews date back more than a decade, but here's the thing. I still get people asking me when the station will bring them back. So I knew I wanted Frank as my inaugural guest on Northern Soundings. I recorded this interview with him back last summer when he was the Alaska Writer Laureate. That distinction is now passed on to Ernestine Hayes. But this is why, in the show, you'll hear me refer to his work in that capacity. Here's Frank reading from his collection of essays, Unpleasantries, Considerations of Difficult Questions.
Where do most of us go nowadays when we go looking for the dead? The first mummy I ever saw was in Basel, Switzerland. I was bumming around Europe. It was a Sunday, and I couldn't think of anything to do except visit the small nearby museum. There it was, all unwrapped and about the size I was in the fourth grade. Recognizable as a crudely formed human being, but that's about it. Not at all like my Uncle Joe in his casket. Not at all like my mom when her heart stopped, her blood stopped circulating, and the color drained from her face. A dead person with no place left to be except in this hermetically sealed glass case. Just outside Charlottesville, Virginia, is an experimental station run by the Virginia Department of Transportation. There, cadavers are placed in cars, crashed into other cars with a cadaver at the wheel, and inspected for damage. I think of my dad when I pass by. My dad had hoped to give his body to be used by a medical student at the University of Virginia, where he had been treated and cured of cancer the first time around. These days, though, once a person donates his corpse to the state, he has no say in how it might be used or how it might be disposed of. Once it has served its purpose, the remains are cremated. We have no idea where my dad's ashes went.
Frank Sose, reading from his collection of essays, Unpleasantries, Considerations of Difficult Questions. Welcome, Frank. In that passage, you tackle several big themes the essay's known for, and you consider them in the long view.
Yeah, I think we have to take the long view. I may have been taking the long view for a good while, but it's a question that as I was putting this collection together and looking at the contents, I thought, boy, there's a There are a lot of dead people in this book, and I hadn't really thought about it that much as a cumulative problem, but there it is.
The other form you reference in your preface is the short story or fiction, in the sense that we like to have things tied up pretty neatly. We want at least an emotional resolution.
There has to be a resolution that may not make the reader happy, but needs to make the reader satisfied. And that's a big difference. What happens when you're writing a short story, at least when I'm writing a short story, is that you're always working with diminished returns. Every action that happens precludes a lot of actions that aren't going to happen. So as the story goes forward, you're peeling away possibilities until you get to an end. And as Milan Kundera would say, quoting from that Beethoven, "Must it be, it must be," so that when Anna Karenina throws herself under the train, we readers have to also feel like there was no other choice for that character. When Emma Bovary poisons herself, that those are choices the character has been driven to, but they've really been driven to them by the options that are considered at different crux points in the story, and the one that carries the character forward. So as you go along, the choices get narrower. Things just skinny down to this inevitable moment.
You're accomplished in both the short story, your collection, Unified Field Theory, won the Flannery O'Connor Award, and you've been praised for your essays by guys like Phil Lopate and others. For a guy like you, one version kind of just sprays out these questions, and the other one winnows down into inevitability.
Do they work
against each other for you as a writer?
Well, there's certainly two different ways of thinking, and they require two different mindsets. But the difficulty with the essay is that when I'm teaching this, I often draw a picture that sort of looks like a nuclear chain reaction, because one idea does lead to another idea to another idea, and it's not linear. I'm getting ready to teach this class down in Anchorage, and I'm going to begin with two pictures from a Stephen Jay Gould book about biology, and one of them is an illustration of the evolution of the horse as was traditionally presented, probably even up into the 50s and 60s mostly, and it is a linear progression. And then Gould has another map of the progression of the evolution of the horse, and it's much more involved and much more complicated. So at one point in this country, there were 16 different species of horse that we would call horses. So that we're attracted, I think people are attracted to that linear progression. It's certainly Western thinkers are. But thought is not exactly linear, at least the way I think. And I think to kind of cram it into a linear pattern is a little deceptive, and it's often undercutting your larger aims, because you have to shear a lot away to get the linear arc to work.
Well, another diagram that works in your essay is, I would say, almost a spiral. You circle around to recurring elements or themes in your essays. So are these the stuff you gnaw on when you're not actually at the desk?
I don't know. I guess these are the ones that I've managed to gnaw into some kind of translatable shape. You know, one of the questions I ask myself often is if I'm covering the same ground too often, and if I'm bringing anything really new and fresh to the question, if I return to it. And in a question that's mostly an aesthetic question, I think the answer can often safely be yeah. I mean, it's, as I said, you wander around in there and you never come out. But for other questions, I don't know. I think, you know, a person lives his life and questions occur, and you grow through some questions, you grow away from some questions, but others persist and you just keep coming back to them.
You reference a great many painters or visual works of art, but not much music. But you used to play an instrument, and you still are incredibly knowledgeable about all genres and that. So why not so much on music, do you think?
I don't know. For one thing, I think I used to tell my students this who wanted to write something about music. It's very hard to make music work in words. That's part of it. But the other part is I don't think because I didn't have that level of education, I think I'm often out of my limit. I know some things about music because I just things stick to my brain, but I don't think I have a good thought through understanding of a lot of music. Yeah, I was a adequate saxophone player, but at that time in my life, I cared much more about being a more than adequate basketball player, so I never really tried to think about my horn as much as I should have. And I do miss that. Playing music is fun, and doing it cooperatively is also, it's something different. And so I do regret letting that go, and I recognize that at this age, at this stage in my life, I'm not going to return. At some point, you say, okay, there are things I'm going to have to do that do kind of well, and I need to stick to those instead of broadening out at this point.
My guest today on Northern Soundings is Frank Sose, writer, teacher, and, as it happens, dedicated athlete. On any given day, you might find Frank on the Nordic ski trails or pedaling his road bike along the often broken asphalt around Fairbanks. And I asked him about that. You take delight in physical activity, and in some ways, I think in the essay on skiing at university trails, you work it through your body as much as your noggin.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And there was an essay actually in the New York Times just 2 days ago about thinking and, in this case, stillness, because the author of this piece was arguing for like a quiet sitting meditation. That doesn't work for me very well. But I think that his argument was that our brains, our executive brains, spend a lot of time doing things like remembering phone numbers, remembering all the errands we're supposed to do when we go to town. And he would say because of that, they keep our more creative brains at bay. So if you put yourself in a meditative state, in a still state, in a room with a lot of without many distractions, ideas will come to you, and that's probably true. But I don't like to be still. And I'm physically just not very comfortable sitting in chairs. And so, when I teach, I run around the room a lot because I feel like I think better when I'm in motion.
Bakewell, in her book on Montaigne, says he really wrote through that to how to live well. And exercise clearly must be an element in your living well. Do you think writing serves a similar function for you, Frank?
As a way of teaching me how to live well? I suppose. I mean, you spend this time thinking, and I think that's healthy in a lot of important ways. So in that regard, yeah. And you mentioned in your note to me the Stoics. And the Stoics are all about, especially in retirement, planning a good death. And I think, you could do that. But there's something, it seems to me, incredibly passive about just saying, well, I mean, we know we're going to die, but it doesn't mean we have to just sit there and try to say, well, okay, we're going to die. So I think you want to get past that. The other element of this that goes hand in hand with just the gross physical activity, skiing and riding my bike and fishing all day, is small physical activity, which I think is also useful in thinking. I usually tie my own flies, so I'll do a lot of fly tying in the winter. I work on my bikes and skis a lot, and so those activities, those physical activities, often if you're waxing a ski, you're doing something that's familiar to you and you've done it many times, so you, part of your brain really is thinking about waxing a ski, but then you are freeing your brain to do other things. And there's something relaxing and satisfying about doing handwork, and also something that lends itself to maybe a more immediate sense of getting something done. And you can tie a fly in 20 minutes, and so it's done. And if it looks okay, it's going to work. It's going to catch a fish. And sometimes you can work for months and months on a story or an essay, and sometimes it's never quite exactly right.
One of the wonderful essays in your collection makes the comparison with building a canoe.
Yeah.
Which you admit it's not something you'd done before and maybe not naturally gifted towards that. But you do get a sense, and there's something about the shape of a canoe that lends itself to both that aesthetic quality and that satisfaction of working with your hands at the same time.
Yeah, and I feel that very strongly. I've often thought about different craft ideas as a vocation, and I think my difficulty with that finally would be that I would lose interest too quickly. That, and at some point, at the very high end of craft, I probably just don't have the skills to make it happen. So for building a boat or, say, building a bamboo fly rod, not just restoring one, you've really got to have good skills, and I admire that. I think we don't value that level of skill enough in this culture, and in fact, we've almost let it get completely away.
Well, this goes back then to aesthetics and the sense of beauty, and I'm wondering, for you, is there a redemptive quality about that? Often the issues and the topics you take up are difficult ones, painful ones, and with no clear solution in mind, but you, through the craft of your writing and the lyricism of it, do manage to find something aesthetically redeeming, I would say.
Boy, that's a tough question, and I'm not sure we ever satisfactorily answer that. I mean, there's we would like to believe that. I think that modernism, literary and artistic modernism, is predicated on some notion that art in its redemptive power will rescue us from the void. And it's, you know, I guess as Jake Barnes would say, isn't it pretty to think so?
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. My guest is Frank Soes. His latest book of essays, Unpleasantries, Considerations of Difficult Questions, has just been published by University of Washington Press. Frank also currently serves as Alaska's Writer Laureate, and I continued our discussion by asking him what that means to him. You're right now Writer Laureate for Alaska. Tell me about that. Do you have a lot of obligations associated with that? And do you find people expect certain things from you, like you're going to be a guru or?
Boy, I don't think people expect me to be a guru. The job kind of invites the writer to make his own expectations. And that's nice. But what I've realized is that I have to say, you know, if you want me to, I'll come to your town and I'll give a talk. I can do a workshop. I wasn't sure when I got into this that I wanted to do a lot of work with high school and middle school kids, but I've had some fun work with high school and middle school kids. And I taught high school for a while, so I do still have the recessive skills. needed to manage a high school classroom. I think it hasn't changed that much. But so you kind of make your own way when you're the state writer, and the budget's pretty small. I just did a week on the Kenai, and part of it was to go to the writers' conference, but I did an event in Seward, and I did an event in Nilchik, and I spent 3 nights camping at the Starisky Point campground. So it makes my budget go a little bit farther.
Yeah, but, top flight.
Yeah, but I like my tent, and I was able to sneak a day of fishing in there, too.
I want to touch briefly on how you do your work. Montaigne had his study where he had these epigrams or little sayings on the beams of a ceiling and whatnot. What's your physical space? How does that work for you?
I have two spots at our house, and we have a little desk that's sort of off of our main living area where my wife, Margot Klass, and I have computers that are kind of side by side, and I can and do work there, but I have a study up the hill. It's a little storage shed that we had windows put in and bookcases put in, and so I can go up there and be pretty much removed from, say, the phone. I did discover by accident, and I regret that I did, that because the window of my studio and the window near where our little wireless gadget is are kind of aligned, that I can actually get email and Google eyes things from my study. And I'm sorry I can, actually. But once I discovered it, you know, the genie was out of the bottle.
The idea for me when I think about Montaigne is a guy who's got this special room at the top of his tower, you know, and working away, happy as a clam at high tide. But he knows there's an audience out there. You, because you're a much more sophisticated guy in many ways about how essays interact with the readership, you really do kind of engage in a dialogue, even though you're not in dialogue. Does that make sense?
Yeah, although I'm not sure to the degree that Montaigne was confident about an audience. He that was a trial too, but when he brought out the first edition, it was a hot seller. He had what would be the Renaissance equivalent of a book tour, and he did very well. That's why there's a second and third edition of the essays, because he kept selling them, and he kept actually revising them too as he went. But so I'm not sure what he did think about in terms of audience. But I can't guess that. But I don't think that he pictured them as being quite as interactive as I might. But I don't think there's any way of knowing that for sure either.
Since you have taught so many distinguished writers, do you have any observations about the state of literature either in Alaska or in general?
I say this every time I give a talk about Alaskan writers. There are more writers and more good writers in Alaska right now than there ever have been. If you go all the way back, and I'll often say, when I came to Alaska 30 years ago, if I'd been asked to give a talk about the Alaska writers that matter, it would be a very short talk. And now I have to call. I've only got a limited amount of time. A lot of the writers I talked about last summer, I'm not talking about this summer, even though I've got different audiences. I'm just trying to talk about different people. But in our country, the question of how serious our literature is troublesome. I mean, we've got a little handful of well-regarded, complicated writers like Don DeLillo, who do seem to get press, who do seem to have some level of recognition. But the publishing has really become a biz that's almost as unattractive as Hollywood, where junk sells and repetitive junk sells. So I think at that level, it's crummy. If you're looking for good writing, you probably aren't looking, say, on the New York Times bestseller list. There are books that get there. They're kind of the exception rather than the rule. I don't know what to say about that, because I was on a little panel in Anchorage, and I asked the audience, where do you go to learn about the books you want to read? And because, like, the New York Times book review, which I've subscribed to now for almost 40 years, I threw away a book review from the early 80s when I was cleaning out my studio. It probably had triple the number of reviews a New York Times book review has now. I threw away one from the late 90s. It probably had still about double the number of books the review has now. So the number of reviews that are out there to see is shrinking, and that's a problem. And so I think people are trying different ways to find what's good, because a lot of what's good is now at small presses that really have a hard time getting reviewed.
That's it for this week's show. This is part one of a visit with Frank Soos, currently Writer Laureate for Alaska. His book, Unpleasantries, Considerations of Difficult Questions, has just been published by University of Washington Press. Next episode, I'll ask him about some of his other works undertaken with visual artists, including the painter Kes Woodward. Kes's portrait of Frank is used with permission. Music for Northern Sounding is drawn from No Finer Place by Julie Rafferty. My thanks to the artist for permission to use it. Until next time, I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Thanks for joining me.